Hey, podcast listeners, thanks for tuning in to Moboco Audio. The episode you're about to listen to is the second episode in a series titled Understanding the Influence of Attachment on Behavior, featuring behavior specialist Carla Braber. Now, in the first episode, Carla helped us understand that, from an attachment perspective, all behavior is a form of communication. Our role as caregivers and educators is to, quote, crack the code of behavior, read its meaning, and then try to create secure attachments with children. So when you next walk, run, bike, or drive, why not download that episode and give it a listen? Meanwhile, enjoy today's episode called Attachment is for Life. Hey Carla, how are you? As I was thinking about our theme today, I played a little association game.
That's great. Tell me more about that.
Well, I wanted to think of a song that best captured the theme of today's episode.
And what did you come up with?
So the song, I think, that summarizes the theme of our podcast today is Somebody to Love by Queen. For no matter how old we are or who we are, we all seek secure attachments, which, in a way, is a kind of love, to help us feel connected in our relationships and secure in the world.
Well, that's a great song to pick, and thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Now, perhaps our listeners will share some of their own selections. Okay, so what's on our topic list for today?
Yeah, Chris, in our last session on All Behavior Has Meaning, we've talked about how attachment spans over the lifetime. We all have needs in order to grow and develop, but these needs, they continue from cradle to grave. And again, how we express these needs, however, changes over the lifetime, and it changes with development.
So what are these needs, and are they the same for all of us?
You know, that's a really great question, and I'm wondering if maybe you and I and our listeners could build the list together. So for those of you that are listening, think about what children need in order to grow and develop. So Chris, maybe you can start us off.
Sure. Bit of a lightning round. Here we go. They need love, connection, independence.
Yeah. Yeah. And touch, security. A common one is to feel understood. Very importantly, they need to feel a sense of safety.
Mm-hmm. Appreciation, respect, trust, maybe support.
And for our students, friends, and also they need boundaries, right? They really need to have a structure and routine.
Then there are basic needs, I guess, as well, right? Such as food, shelter, but also predictability in one's world, safety, as we mentioned.
Yeah, and this is a really important list, and I encourage teams to build a list of your own when you're back at your schools, because these lists are really at the core of what children are expressing in terms of what their behavior is doing. So it's really important to build this list and make it live and active and keep adding to it.
Very true. And the relationships we establish with one another to both get our needs met is constantly in a kind of negotiative dance over time that evolves, isn't it?
So absolutely. Change is one of the biggest constants, paradoxically. So now let's think about how children show these needs at different stages of development. So for those of you who are parents or who have a connection to young children, think about how your child expressed what they needed before they had language. We talked about babies last time. Now I want you to think a little bit more about from the ages of 1 to 2. Another way to think about this, because not everybody's been around small children, but if you've been in a restaurant and you've been seated beside a young toddler or in an airplane, think about the different ways that toddlers are expressing their needs.
Okay. So maybe laughing, playing, sometimes whining or crying.
Yeah, they can have temper tantrums, right. Start to run away. But interestingly, they look back to see if you're still there. Mm-hmm. Some come up and they want to be snuggled. Other children can tend to be more clingy.
Putting their hands up to let me know they want to be picked up.
Yeah, so let's take the action of putting your hands up to be picked up. I like that one. What attachment need do you think that might be linked to?
Possibly wanting to feel loved, connected, maybe just get a bit of security.
Mm-hmm. What about running away and then calling an adult or looking back at the adult?
Yeah. So I guess one interpretation or cracking of that code might be that the child actually feels safe enough to explore more beyond the parent's immediate orbit, wants to let the adult know that she is more independent, but also needs to know that the caregiver is still there, kind of within eyesight. It's funny because both my daughters had curious ways of expressing this kind of a thing. My youngest, for example, when quite little and playing, say, in a park with other kids and us there to oversee, would periodically run up to my partner and say, "Mommy, skinny skin," and rub her fingers lightly along the inside of my partner's bare wrist. Aww. Then she would kiss her wrist and just head right back off to play.
That is so adorable and a real safety thing for her and a way of checking back. You know, I'm here, you're mm-hmm. still here. And we've discussed in the past how children differ in the ways that they express their needs. And adults also differ in what needs we attend to. Some of us may pay more attention to some behaviors than others. And some of this has to do with our past story. And some of this has to do with fit and tolerance.
Mm. Can you talk a little more about that concept of fit between child and the adult dyad?
Yeah. Some adults feel confident in attuning to a child's needs when they are infants or toddlers, and others feel more confident as they become more verbal or they are closer to adolescence. It's not that we are good or bad at it, it's just where our comfort zone lies.
Now, coming back to needs, how is it that children express their needs differently as they develop?
Well, let's think about our students. So how do students in the classroom, so this is going to be depending on your grade, if you're listening to this, express their needs to you now? So let's, for example, think about a student in grade 8. What are some of the ways they express their attachment needs?
Yeah, I mean, it'll vary widely. One child might spend a lot of time with her head down. Another might blow hot and cold. "I like you one minute, I can't stand you the next." Others might not want to be around adults at all and will only engage with their peers. And yet some might only seek adult connection. Still, I guess others, you know, rarely attend school and find ways to get kicked out to avoid that connection.
Yeah, and some children express their needs through conflict, physically or mm-hmm. verbally. And teachers feel that's the only way the student knows how to engage. And they have this constant need for engagement. Other kids, you feel like you just can't fill up their bucket. You
right.
fill more yeah. and more, and then you turn away for even just a small moment, and they're eliciting your attention again.
And then still others, you know, are going to be helpful students, respectful, smiling, engaging in work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's think about conflict and what that means when the student engages in that behavior. It may be verbal or it may be physical. How might you interpret that as you attempt to understand the attachment need? Like, what would you might you predict the meaning is behind their behavior?
Well, I might think the student is working to express their own opinions and values, albeit forcefully, as an identity they're exploring for themselves. I might wonder if they're testing me to see if I'll reject them, or it might be a need for control. They might be trying to establish independence and distance from me as the adult, which, you know, is a natural part of a teenager's development.
Absolutely. How about only wanting to engage with peers?
Again, you know, that may be an attempt to gain independence, autonomy from the adult attachment relationship, or it could be a combination of the child trying to shape their identity and alignment with their peers, but also wanting to know if I will still be there for them. Now, Carla, as we work through these examples, it seems to me there's a tension between that biological drive for a youth's autonomy and selfhood and the innate human need to be connected. It would be odd if my daughter as a teenager was still running up to her mom and touching her wrist, then running back to her friends to hang out. But that tension can be confusing and even hurtful at times.
Adults often feel like the student does not want to be attached to them, and this can be extremely difficult. At the same time, many adolescents, for example, try very hard to convince themselves that they don't need adults, and it may be very difficult for them to show you that they need you. They may have experienced rejection in the past.
And this comes back to the child's life story of attachment relationships and how their needs have been met in the past, which creates that kind of internal working model about relationships. And these are the layers of a child's life story in their metaphoric backpack that we spoke about previously, isn't it? Thus, our caregiver goal is to provide what you've called a safe haven and secure base within that dyadic relationship from which children can extend outward into the wider relational world, gain autonomy, and experience success, no?
Yeah, so let me define this a little bit more specifically. So internal working models are best thought of as a deep structure, or roadmap is actually helpful in the organization of memory, cognition, and emotional behavioral regulation. So they create attachment patterns, and these patterns are based on beliefs about ourselves. Am I worthy of love? Beliefs about others. Are adults reliable or capable of meeting my needs? And in a secure adult-child relationship, and by that I mean providing secure experiences and not attempting to fix the child to be secure, it opens the door for children to organize their experiences of the self in relation to others, which actually promotes that coherence in memory. Because when children have experienced, for example, trauma or maltreatment, memory is one of the first things that becomes very challenging. It also helps with their emotions and their behavior and cognition. So when kids are stressed, this system or the roadmap will actually help them to, have that sense and feeling that I can go out there, I can reach out, but there will still be someone there for me when I come back. A secure adult-child relationship, and by that I mean providing secure experiences, opens the door for children to organize their experiences of the self in relation to others and the world, which actually promotes coherence in memory. Because remember, when children have experienced trauma or maltreatment, for example, memory is very sporadic. Helps with managing emotions, behavior, and the cognition. So when kids are stressed, this system, or the roadmap, if you will, provides a powerful support for regulating feelings and behaviors. A child with a backpack full of secure relationship patterns will have an internal script of sort that lets them know they can manage in a stressful situation and things will be okay. It's not going to be perfect, because that's not the point, but that there will be somebody back, a landing, as you put it, for them to come back to. Whereas children who have experienced, and this is real or perceived, insecurity in relationships with adults don't have this foundation to rely on, and so might flounder emotionally and behaviorally and present as dysregulated when faced with challenges, especially in times of stress.
Okay, now by way of example, do you mind if I ask you to think back to how you expressed your needs to educators when you were a student?
I actually have an example that really stands out for me, and I'm going to go way back to grade 5, but I won't tell you how many years that is. I shared a teacher with an older sibling. I came a few years later, and my older sibling would describe this teacher as her favorite all-time teacher and mentor. And let's just say we were very different students. So very quickly, I began to feel like this teacher didn't like me. And remember, it is about the student's perception. I was compared to my sibling almost daily, and as a result, I simply stopped engaging in work. Of course, I wasn't really consciously aware of what I was doing or why. And we talked about this in our podcast last week, how behavior is really complexing, as it resulted in further negative interactions between the teacher and I. So fast forward, about 3 months later, I was placed in a class for students with learning difficulties for reading and math. And that teacher had a very different teaching style. So I quickly began to engage in work. So I remember very clearly, it was about a week or two in, and the teacher asked me to stay after school. And he said, so clearly you can read. And I might argue that you can read above your grade level. And math isn't a problem. So what's going on? And of course, I was not really even that aware, but I just said, well, the teacher doesn't like me. And I think he thinks I'm stupid. So why would I bother doing anything? We can talk about how ridiculous that was and how it was not functional. But the point was, I expressed my anger and frustration through noncompliance. I just simply stopped working. Was the teacher aware of what I needed through my expression of needs? Likely not. It's not easy for educators, and it really does require a lot of curiosity.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard for adults to be perfect in all situations, isn't it? I mean, it's doubly hard to maintain the provide a safe haven, don't take the bait stance when a child or student, you know, is telling you to F off or that they hate you and hate school. What do you think the teacher could have done differently?
Well, it's so true. And even when we try to be supportive and talk to our students, they may not accept it. So absolutely, it's not about being perfect at all. And there's no magic bullet. Finding the right time to talk is really important, though, because timing really matters. Sometimes the best adult approach in these moments is to say absolutely nothing, right? But just to listen. And I know that that's not easy to do. And with that in mind, Chris, can you think of situations where it was easier to talk to students when you were in schools?
I think I've found the best times for this are what we might think of as the, quote, in-between times. So these are the more informal opportunities to connect. For example, when kids arrive before school starts, you can connect by greeting them on the playground. Or when you're walking around the grounds or in the hallways at break times, I always tried to find those natural intersection moments and avoid making connection too public, unless, of course, I knew the child was fine with that. For example, I wouldn't come into a class in the middle of a lesson and announce that I needed to speak with Pavan. I would find a much quieter way to do that. And I think finding those natural moments, of course, is not always easy. I mean, sometimes certain students have learned to definitely avoid the adult-child connections. It was also very important to me that I didn't engage when I was angry, frustrated, or upset. I was definitely not at my best when I was tired or if I was juggling a lot of other things. So getting the timing of these factors was definitely challenging. Which means, of course, it's even more challenging for teachers and support staff to find a good time, too, when they're there in the heat of the moment all the time in the classroom.
Yeah, and it's extremely challenging. And I'm going to keep going back to the importance of having empathy for yourself. And it really might require that you ask for help. It's not a measure of your competency. The goal is being able to interact with the child in a way that keeps putting something back into the backpack. And you asked me the question earlier, and I realized I didn't answer, what might that teacher have done differently?
Right.
And it's really difficult to know, because it would be a function of how that teacher would make me feel in his different attempts in order for me to know if that was effective or not. I just know that the other teacher didn't make me feel like I was incompetent.
And again, we come back to reinforcing that pay it forward concept. Every little moment, every small action we do to provide a model of security and safe haven in the adult-child relationship does add a layer that can help shape the child's internal working model. And as you've noted before, while we all want to be perfect, we only need to get it right a relatively small percentage of the time.
Yes, and I love your pay it forward metaphor. You really only need to get it right only about 30% of the time. It's quite remarkable, which I hope is comforting
to school staff. Not that we're goaling for only 30%, but that's enough to actually shift an internal working model.
Yeah, which is super helpful for people to know. Now, Carla, earlier we were talking about needs. I wonder if we can come back to that. So regardless of a child's age, are there some needs that come up over and over again despite ages and stages of development?
There are two basic needs that come up over and over that are expressed in so many ways. The need to be connected and the need to be independent. And these are the core of all relationships. Some behaviors serve to bring us closer, connected, but we also need to be separate, independent. And we're constantly trying to find a balance. And this brings us back to cracking the code.
Okay, so do you have some suggestions for how we can navigate these tricky waters? When to decode a need for connection and when to decode a need for autonomy? For it's really a bit of a two-sided coin, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is where it becomes challenging because one expression of needs can mean two different things. So, for example, a child might come out and poke the bear by tapping a child or sitting too close. In an older student, they may enter the classroom and engage in inappropriate language, etc. For one student, this may be a strategy they use to connect to that person. Yet for another student, it may be the strategy to disengage. So think about that student who comes into the room swearing. What do you think his motivation might be?
Well, given what you've said, I need not to jump to conclusions, but rely on what I know about the student, my relationship with him, to try to make some best guesses. The student might want to ask her to leave the room, so disengagement might actually be testing me to see if I will kick him out, but really he wants me to keep connected and ensure that I make him stay. Another student might be trying to be just popular with peers. Sometimes it's probably just plain hard to know.
Yeah, not only is it hard to know, but it can change from day to day. And with some of our kids, it can change from minute to minute. And if you consider this student may have an undiagnosed learning challenge, what would be a good way to keep that a secret?
Yeah, get kicked out. That way you don't have to try to do the work and reveal that you're actually struggling.
Absolutely. So your response to the behaviors and the results it may give you provides clues about what the needs are, right? And this is dynamic. It never stops. And as we discussed in our first principle, your attempt to try is what builds the security, right? The fact that you're stepping back and trying different things, that what starts to change the internal working model. Because if you think about patterns, they may have a pattern that leads them to believe they're not worthy of that curiosity. So the keys to remember is that we all have attachment needs. The expression of these change over development. In most cases, if you think about how an infant expresses their need to be fed, for example, is through cry, fast forward to a toddler, adolescent, etc., how you express hunger changes over time, I would hope anyway. And there's no set map. And many factors play a role in development of expression of needs.
No, I'd argue that it doesn't mean we're always shooting blind in our efforts to crack that code and get it right. It seems to me that the more effort we put in to know the student, to build that secure, safe haven relationship, and work to interpret the signs over time, that has to improve our accuracy with interpreting their needs.
Yes.
In other words, success is often more about us than the student. For example, when I think about an adolescent's push for independence and self-identity, despite having more language, they're not always able to articulate their feelings and what they need. In fact, they might not actually be aware of what their need really is. And so we need to work all the harder, particularly when the adolescent is being volatile, to remain emotionally present with them, open to interpretations of what their need might be as their behavior is expressing it.
Yeah, for sure. And then often we try to navigate what the underlying need is. We experience conflict. Right. So think about the, you know, that need to be connected and independent in the middle of there is can be some conflict. So think about a time when perhaps you've tried to name a feeling and accompanying need only to have it blow up on you because you got it wrong or the student doesn't actually recognize this as the need. So an example is you might say, I get you might be feeling frustrated and need help to do this math. Only to have the student throw the pencil, turn over the desk, and yell, I don't need any of your bleeping help, What I need is you to stop analyzing me and let me out of this damn class and some other colorful language that may be attached.
Yeah. Managing conflict. Sounds like we've got a topic for another episode.
We do. In our next session, we can talk about how we can understand this interpretive dance that we do to stay connected with our students, even when we are in conflict.
I'm looking forward to it.
As well.
Well, Carla, thanks for playing with me again today. I'm looking forward to next week.
Thank you.
Hey, listeners. I wonder if before we close, we can play the association game. Now, at the beginning of this episode, I suggested a song that I think captured the theme for the day. Now, I hope you share some suggestions of your own that speak to you with respect to your big takeaways from today's episode. Feel free to share these at the podcast page on the moboco.weebly.com webpage. Meanwhile, I want to invite you to play a more existential association game. Now, it's a double-barreled one, actually, and here's the first part. When you're near the water, a lake, ocean, or a river, perhaps sitting on a beach or on a dock, think about how that experience makes you feel and why. Now hold those thoughts and feelings in your mind. Now think about the similarity between the waves on that beach and shoreline to the attachment relationship between adults and young people. What connections do you make? I invite you to consider these as you return, either later today or tomorrow, to work with your students. How do you want that experience to feel and be for both you and your students? Now, given our little association exercise and the insights about attachment being for life that Carla shared with us today, I want to close the podcast with a bit of a Hallmark ending. Like waves or beaches, no two adults and children are the same, yet they're inextricably connected. The waves influence and alter the beach over time. The composition of the beach, whether rocky or sandy, straight or contoured, influence how the waves move along that shoreline. The relationship between the two changes over the course of a year and over the years. It's dependent on the vagaries of other things, such as the weather. Ultimately, though, the connection is eternal. Similarly, the attachments we have with children are, in a way, eternal. They leave a pattern and a history, which we've called layers in a backpack, within a child's story that lasts for life. And so, our role is to help students have that feeling we get when we're on the beach experiencing the waves against the shore, a feeling of calm, certainty that there is predictability, stability in the world, and that all things will roll on in a way that is both reassuring, beautiful, and profoundly secure. This is Chris. You're listening to Mobile Co Audio. See you next time.